Okay, Google, find me a podcast about War Machine and Hordes, please.
All right, I have a podcast ready to go. Let's start with Tangential with Sung Su.
Okay, Google, do you have any more information about the podcast?
It's a War Machine and Hordes podcast whose goal is to educate, inspire, and entertain.
Okay, Google, play Tangential with Sung Su.
Today, we have our first ever returning guest, Matt McWaters. We talk about Lock and Load, and he explains why he's so hyped about Crucible Gari. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to stay up to date, if you don't mind taking a second to give us a like or a follow on social media, that would be greatly appreciated. You can find me on Facebook at CO Wargaming or on Twitter at Sung Su, TSEUNGTSU. Without further delay, here's that conversation. He couldn't stay away, and I couldn't say no. Okay, truth be told, I begged him to come back. Our first returning guest, Matt McWaters. Matt, how you doing?
I'm great. Always excited to talk to you.
Yeah, I feel like we talk every day, but it's great to have you on the podcast. So I had to miss it, Matt, but I know you made Lock and Load. How was it? What was the highlight of this year's Lock and Load?
So this is my first Lock and Load this year, and honestly, I wasn't 100% on going beforehand, but I did end up qualifying for IG. So I was like, you know what? Free ticket, I'm going to go. And everyone had been hyping it to me. I had a genuinely good time. I have to say it was probably the most enjoyable convention I've been to. Some of that has to do with the games I played, but most of that has to do with the people I met. Whether it's the people I know, like I've talked to a long time, you know, veteran convention goers that I've met, or just new people that talking to about interesting matchups in their metas, it was really enjoyable. And I brought my girlfriend Alicia along with me, and she had a really great time. She didn't play a single game of War Machine the entire weekend. She just was in the painting room and in the cosplay room, like they doing that stuff. I saw her for like 2 hours out of the entire weekend. We went to dinner and like she was just back to painting and cosplay stuff. It was amazing. And the field at that convention was incredibly strong. I played 16 games over the weekend, like 16 real games over the weekend. And every game was against an amazing player that really was trying his best to not only do well, but, you know, be the best sportsman he could.
Yeah, going to big events was always fascinating for me. You get to meet all these players you've never met before, but through social media or some other way, you end up hearing about them. How have players' reputation lived up to their realities if you've met them?
I think the big thing about meeting the quote-unquote stars of War Machine, if you would, is that, you know, they're the legends of them is oftentimes much grander than who they are as people. To give a little short story, when I started playing War Machine, I started with Circle. And when I started like actually trying to win games, the lists I immediately went to and started playing were Brett Fogels. Now, having never met him before that point, this is Mark II, of course, having never met him, never even been to a convention, I played his lists. And like, as he tells it, those lists were taken from someone else, but they were still his lists associated with his name for me. Meeting Brett in person was a really interesting experience, and I've met him obviously a while ago now, and we've become friends. But every time you meet someone who you've only hear about, like Patrick Dunford or Aaron Whaley or any of these guys, where you meet them and you're like, wow, these are the best players, and you have a conversation with them, and it's amazing. The reputations players build are oftentimes a product of commitment and effort in the game. So like when you talk to Patrick Dunford, and his reputation is as like a good, clean player, the Pat Bot. He's a robot that doesn't lose the same way twice. And you meet him and you talk to him, and he's just the nicest guy you've ever met. And that's the common thing between most high-level players, I think. And you talk to these guys and you watch them play, and their reputation precedes them as good, clean players that are kind of, you know, paragons of the community. They're what you should aspire to be in competitive play. And they get that way by playing clean, concise games, and if they fuck something up or if something goes wrong, they are the first person to call themselves on it and find the correct solution. And I think that's a really big point, is that good players that build good reputations and want to be known as good players strive to put their best foot forward, because everyone you meet, every single person you interact with, has some information about you. Hears about you, whether it's from a friend, from someone else. And you don't even have to be a big name player. Like I played against a guy round two at Lock and Load that I, you know, heard about from someone else. And someone told me, watch out, that guy does some pretty sloppy measurements. And I've never met the guy. And like, my guy only played him in a casual game, but like that was something going into that game I was aware of. And that's kind of the thing. Like, when you hear about these really great players, no one says that. Everyone says they are the cleanest players. They're the best players. And I think that's an important statement. That's player reputation to me, I guess, is striving to be the best player you can so that when people talk about you, they don't point out how you measure sloppily or like you try to abuse whatever rule. Like, play well, play clean, and do your best.
Great point, Matt. And I guess since I'm making a podcast now, I hope I live up to the expectations of anyone that meets me. What those expectations may be, I have no idea. So other than player reputation, Matt, do you have any funny stories coming out of Lock and Load?
So we're in the middle of round two of Masters, and Brett Fogel comes up to me. Like, him and I had been talking all morning, talking about cool Maelok lists and stuff and like funny meta decisions and all that kind of stuff. And he comes up to me. He's like, Matt, what's your opinion on TEPs? And I basically gave him a whole breakdown of dice variants. I think you did a really good job explaining how this works on your other podcast. And I basically just told him that TEPs are way worse than people think they are, and especially into matchups where people think that they're good. And like the specific matchup we were talking about was Gatsby 3. So Brett is the captain of WTC, as the captain of a WTC team in America. And one of his teammates is Aaron Allen. And he asked me to help him convince Aaron Allen to play without TEPs for WTC. But the way he asked me was quite good. It was, Matt, I need you to save America. And as any good Canadian, I can't turn down that kind of offer. So Aaron and I played a couple games over the weekend where we played a game of Gatsby 3 versus Axis where he had TEPs. And then we took the TEPs out and we played a game where he didn't have TEPs. And I showed him the difference in how that matchup works. And it was a really good experience, not only for me, but also hopefully for him as well. So the point of the story is I saved America. You can thank me anytime.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for saving America. I really appreciate it. And I'm really speechless. I didn't know I had a national hero on the podcast. So in other news about games you played, a mutual friend said they beat your P-Scar list with Connie B, and there were witnesses, and he swears that it was a super clean game, and he has a killer reputation. So do you have any rebuttal to that? Your P-Scar list using two Constance Blaze?
So you're talking about my good man Brandon here. That man is great. I love him. But, I mean, it's hard for him to admit that he just doesn't know how Scar 1 works. I mean, we get to the end of the game, and he's never played Scar 1 or played against her. And I've killed 100% of the models on his table, including his caster. And he just, at the end of the game, he was just amazed. He didn't know that she had Dark Guidance or a feat, and that she had Dark Ritual, or sorry, Ritual Sacrifice. He didn't know anything about Scar 1. He's never played her before, never even played Crix, I heard.
Yeah, that's crazy. You'd think with all the content out there about P-Scar that he would have heard about it. But I mean, hey, you know, sometimes you got to face check the first time into a matchup.
Yeah, I mean, there's a guy who won War Machine Weekend in Lock and Load with Scar, but I don't think it was him.
Yeah, the guy that won was an asshole.
So yeah, definitely. Wasn't him. Yeah.
So for those people who have never been to Lock and Load, you said this was your first one. What is the elevator pitch for going to Lock and Load?
So it's the same way I pitched it to Alicia. So why don't you come hang out with the players from around the world who have the same interest as you, get first access to new stuff and factions coming out, talk with the developers, get inside information, and get painting advice. It has something for everyone, and it's just a great place to hang out. The energy there is fantastic. And, you know, even if I didn't play in Masters or IG, I feel like I would have had an amazing time in Iron Arena just grinding games and meeting interesting people.
All right, and I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Next year, 2019, you can only go to Lock and Load or War Machine Weekend. Which one is it going to be?
Ooh, that's super tough. That is actually super difficult. I've qualified for IG now, so that was like a goal that I achieved. War Machine Weekend, I've never made it into the Invitational. It's tough. It'll have to be Lock and Load. It'll have to be Lock and Load.
Really? Okay. There you go. The savior of America thinks Lock and Load is better than War Machine Weekend. So before we dive into Crucible Guard, which is why we're supposed to be here, what are your thoughts on the new SR 2018 packet? We covered the champions change in episode 1 of Tangential. I thought today maybe we could just focus on Masters real quickly. Big quality of life changes are the removal of Divide and Conquer and the 15-second turn limit vanished. In addition, we have two new scenarios and one changed up one. So Matt, what do you think?
I think a lot of the changes, you know, are pretty self-evident, but I think the biggest change no one is talking about is the number of scenarios with an objective on it. Having an objective available changes a lot about what your list can and can't do, gives you a lot of interesting tools, and many people are overlooking it. It's access to Pathfinder, Repair, or Magic Weapons. It's relevant, and it's in 5 out of 6 scenarios.
Absolutely. And do you think that bodes to a... what's the word I'm looking for? Less of a swarm army and more to a lower model count army to truly leverage the benefit out of that objective?
Well, I think that SR 2018 punishes slow model count armies, and like especially slow armies. If you look at Mirage, you can score 6 points in a turn in a hypothetical world. And very often you're going to be able to score 3 or 4, like minimum 2. And like that creates a super live scenario where being unable to contest far pieces or being unable to threaten far pieces or get to where you need to go over terrain or whatever just creates really bad situations. It's like it's why that objective in that middle of that circle is so important. Giving a Warjack Pathfinder and running it, you know, 10 inches to contest 2 flags is a pretty strong scenario pace. It's good.
So the scenario Matt mentioned was Mirage, and this is 2 offset circular zones, one a little to the left on your side of the table, your opponent's is a little to the right. In the center of those circular zones is an objective. In the dead center of the table, there's a flag. And then on a diagonal line, there's 2 additional flags. So there ends up being 3 flags, your objective, and a circular zone. So you kind of hit on it, but what do you think about Mirage, other than it being really live?
So Mirage is super interesting, right? Like, control casters on Mirage are particularly powerful. So there was a saying, like when I started getting into competitive War Machine and SR 2017 came out, that if you did not have a spread the net solution, you would lose every game on spread the net. It's the same thing on Mirage. If you are not prepared for it, you're going to end up losing those games. Casters like Kruger 2 are especially powerful there. Anytime you can move an opponent's model, you know, 4 to 5 inches, like between TK, feet, gallows, just killing things, throwing things, it's possible to create a situation where Kruger 2 can score 4 points on the bottom of 2 reliably. And like, and that becomes a major issue if you're not prepared for it, right? So this also kind of puts up huge bases into a really beneficial position as well. Not only are huge bases able to contest multiple flags at the same time, or like the circle and 2 flags is like on Mirage, they're kind of like generally the faster ones are generally good. Like we're talking Wraith Engines, Derp Turtles, even ones that are kind of slow, but you can teleport like the Celestial Fulcrum, faster Colossals that are still pretty durable, like the Vulcan, all create situations where you're able to take a scenario presence and then not be pushed out of it. And that's super important, especially on Mirage. And Mirage is the livest scenario I've ever played.
So the other new scenario is called Invasion. And it's in the dead center, there is a vertical rectangular zone. On either edge of it, there's an objective. And then to the left and the right, again, on the center line of the table, there's 2 circular zones. So again, has objectives like you alluded to before. Definitely fewer scoring elements than Mirage. What do we think of Invasion?
So Invasion is a battle for the outside circular zones and just a peace trade in the center. Most armies on Invasion are going to have their battle group and screen dead center and then skirmishing or flanking units on the outsides, contesting and trying to clear the zones. And the pacing of that match will largely be determined by who's able to clear or contest better. And again, this is another thing I keep talking about here is fast models that are able to contest and clear zones and are hard to remove themselves. A good example of models that are hard to remove would be a Hellmouth. Hellmouth on Invasion is incredibly powerful. You put the Hellmouth in the circular zone and then you contest the center zone with its tentacles. Conversely, you put it in the center zone and contest both circular zones with its tentacles. It's incredible. And like Derp Turtles are also really good here. My favorite thing about Invasion, however, is you take the repair objective and then you put a bunch of Slayers in front of the objective in the center zone. And then you put some Slayers in the circular zones. And then if they try to get to your objective, they have to kill your Carapace Slayers and you can repair them with the objective. It's pretty cute. I like it.
All right. Well, I'll have to keep that in mind next time we meet across the table. So the only other thing that really changed in SR 2018 is Recon has had the flags edge in from dead center of the rectangular zones to the inside corner. Is that a big change, or is just makes it a little more live in the fight in the middle?
So the biggest change about Recon 2 doing that is now a huge base can no longer fit between your objective and your flag. It's a half inch too large to fit there. So it makes movement kind of awkward because due to the speed of most huge bases, you're like that's usually where most end up moving. And especially if you're a shooting huge base like a Blightbringer, you in Recon 2 usually spend your entire game towing your zone with, by your flag and being near like in that little gap, which you can no longer be in. That's the biggest change in my mind. Obviously, having the flag more centered makes it easier to contest as well and easier to protect. So you can, in fact, like wrap it in models and protect it a lot easier because it's closer to center without giving up too much board position. It is still very live, and you can now run from corner to, or from flag to flag much easier than you could before.
Okay, so closing on SR 2018, what do we think? Good, bad? Take a push?
I think that 2018 is going to be the most live scenario packet we've seen to date, and it kind of pushes us away from this, like, I guess it... Again, meta shifting kind of thing, but it kind of pushes us more towards control casters and further away from grind to seven casters. Because now if Haley 2's playing on Invasion, she just TKs your army out of the zone and feats on it. And is like, I score one on my turn. You have to give up your action to walk into the zone to contest. And then I TK you out again and score another one and like and kill you and like do other things. And that's an incredibly powerful decision to make your opponent forced into. So 2018 is going to be great. I have no problems with the game changing in that way. I think the liver of the scenario, the more dynamic choice it creates.
Awesome. So Crucible Guard is obviously Privateer's latest mini faction. What do you think of the mini factions themselves and their annual release schedule? Do you think the mini factions are getting enough love from Privateer Press?
I like new things. Like, just be abundantly clear. I love getting new toys to play with. Who doesn't, right? Like, that's the coolest thing you could get in War Machine is new things. The interactions both Grimkin and Crucible Guard have are super deep and interesting. There's tons of cool things. And if this is kind of what we expect from the future release cycles of these factions, I'm like just even more excited as we go forward. Because as these mini factions come out, they only continue to refine the rule process. They refine CADs, they refine... like how like rules that already exist in the game, as we talked about before. Like, it's great. I'm a big fan. And the other big thing that they talked about at Lock and Load was that they were slowing down their release cycle overall, that they had already gone through their production queue and were now going to focus on legacy models and CIDs. So, you know, when we're sitting here and we're having a bunch of old models that are either rules feel out of date or maybe like just need something, a little bit of a push, points tweak to be new and interesting, and then also new factions are coming out and that being added to the game. I'm excited. It's basically my dream game.
All right, so let's just dive in. I know you're excited about Crucible Guard. So what really caught your eye with them?
The Warcasters. I think they're so deep and interesting. They're super cool. They're like how deep they are is very similar to Grimkin. Every caster has something that they specialize in, and then they bring these super unique tools to that role. So like if your Warcaster is good at one thing, then what they're good at is also unique to them, and like that feels great. I also like there's just their design as a faction. Their faction is designed to function outside of their caster and to have tools for every situation. And then like the Warjacks also are deep toolboxes for the most part. But it's super cool to be like, well, my list, I have to build my list this way to solve this, and then my caster does these things for the list, which feels cool. I think my favorite example in the faction is Locke with a bunch of Tauros, Suppressors, and a few Liberators. Precision Strikes is great, and Road to War feels fantastic when you use it in conjunction with Jackhammer. I love those kind of interactions, and they feel really deep.
Okay, so you mentioned that cool interaction with Locke. You say that the faction's built on these interactions and powerful combos. Are there a couple that we could real quickly dive into?
Yeah, so like obviously the Warcaster and the faction have a lot of deep interaction. So like we already covered Locke and her Jackhammer, Precision Strikes, and Road to War. like obviously with access to grievous wounds and stationary and knockdown and slams and other things, you can do all kinds of soft control elements. My favorite caster in the faction, though, is Baldwin. He is absolutely insane. You're like, oh, I guess I'm going to be an infantry caster in a faction with decent infantry and out of caster support. So like outside of your caster, you have oil, rust, the Dragon's Breath Rocket, which gives -2 to living models. Then you get Baldwin's Feet for prey. And then you take Crucible Guard Infantry, who can shoot fire shots. So after the modifiers, Baldwin can Deadeye them as a battle plan. So like they're 3 dice to hit. They can aim for 2 shots. So the unit is putting out 22 POW 15 Weapon Master shots at a target. And he has snipe on top of it. Like that amount of like just damage fixing, rat fixing, and range fixing from snipe just creates a super cool unit. Like you could apply that across his entire list. It's super deep. He's a monster. And then like if we're talking about cool interactions, how about Lucas Di More? He is unique. There's no other caster that's ever been like him. He has the juice tokens, and like they create a very neat risk reward gameplay where like you have to wager where how many tokens you're going to need on your feet turn to like functionally win the game, but also not kill yourself. So like he has a -2 arm debuff, and like as we talked about Baldwin's prey feat, that obviously creates situations where your infantry hit incredibly hard. He also has a cloud wall, and like Mirage and Iron Flesh both fix a lot of the weaknesses of Crucible Guard units. And then, like, if you play really aggressively, he also has a turn where he's 22 focus and just force hammers and then disintegrates your caster off the table. He does that all with arc nodes that can arc even while engaged. It's fantastic.
No, they definitely sound deep. Coming from Grimken, I really enjoyed the depth of their casters. And can I definitely see the synergies you're talking about with these Crucible Guard casters? So with all that in mind, do you think Crucible Guard is going to be good enough to ship the meta themselves?
I think that the meta will be shifting as Crucible Guard settle in, but maybe not as like a direct result of Crucible Guard. Just like Grimken made people consider having solves for Gremlin Swarms, Crucible Guard will have people like will force people to learn to deal with an entire new set of turns. New set of tools. But I don't think that these tools like that they're going to have to deal with will cause a direct shift. I think that the meta as a whole is going to shift post War Machine Weekend as it does every year. Like, as a result of like Animag and Primal Terrors, Man of War, and Crucible Guard all being on the tail end of like the releases and people not really adjusting their meta choices until after War Machine Weekend, that's when we'll see the shift.
Yeah, and just to echo your point there, one of the things with the faction kind of trickling out as opposed to all coming out early is I definitely think it'll take a little while for people to really adjust to Crucible Guard. So last year, I started playing Grimken, and I bought the army boxes and just kept adding models as they came out. This year, the Crucible Guard schedule is a bit more nuts. Basically, we have release dates for about half the faction, and the rest will come out sometime after October. What do we think about that? Should they have just pushed the entire release of the faction, or are we okay with this slow drizzle?
So I'm kind of in a mixed boat here. The positive side of me says that like it's fine. Like the models will come out when their production status says they're ready, and they've obviously been planning this all out. But I'm the kind of guy who wants all my toys now. I'd much rather pay $1,000 this week to have everything than $200 a week for the next 5 weeks to get things then. And I know that like part of their release cycle's budgeting and like production queue and transportation and distribution and all that stuff. But man, I think that stalling them out over multiple months is probably a good call, especially with such a tight window close to WTC this year. Grimken came out right before WTC last year, and it was still missing a couple pieces. But it was still played by Patrick Dunford, as an example, who did remarkably well with it. And Grimken definitely was a faction that won games because people weren't prepared for it. And I think Crucible Guard's going to be very similar, is that if, like, let's say the whole faction was out for WTC this year, people would have not enough practice. I mean, we're at the end of June here, early July, and it's another 2 months, 3 months of, like, you would have, even if you're like me and you get 10 to 15 games a week, how many of those games are going to be against Crucible Guard players that understand how their faction works? Are like, you're not going to get as much information as you need to succeed against them. So with that said, Crucible Guard will be at WTC this year. I know at least 2 players who are bringing it, and they're not going to have the whole faction, as was discussed. But they will have enough pieces to build a convincing Sevestro list and a convincing Locke list. And, like, of course, like, not having all the tools is bad, but there is a massive dark horse factor. Like, how many people are going to understand the positioning requirements of playing against Locke and Crucible Guard with Countercharge, Road to War, Jackhammer? Like, there's going to be a lot of really weird interactions that people just aren't prepared for. Like, three combat alchemists stationarying a clump of infantry or whatever it may be. So, like, dark horse factor is definitely very real. And spreading out the release cycle does feel awkward, but at the same time, I get it, right?
Sure. So one of the other things I'll hit on real quickly there that's been confusing locally is when exactly are models legal for tournaments? Not as relevant for the small steamrollers, but for someone like you traveling to large conventions or WTC, it can be a little confusing. So would you mind taking a second and just explaining to the listeners when are models legal now?
All right. So models have a street date. If you go on the website, that street date will be on their entry on the website. However, at conventions, any model that is sold at a convention is legal only at that convention where it is sold. So if you bought Crucible Guard at Lock and Load, you could play it in any event there. That said, outside of conventions, models are only legal at their street date. If they come out in an army box, like the Crucible Guard army box, everything will be legal in that army box when the army box hits the normal shelves of your local gaming store. Outside of that, it's just street dates. Worm has nothing to do with it. Conventions have nothing to do with it. Just when their normal release happens, that is when they are legal. Now, if you exist in a meta like mine, and I travel to a lot of conventions, so I'm always buying models before their release. I TO a lot of tournaments, and I participate in other TOs tournaments as well. And we have just a general thing. If you have the models and the models are in War Room, you can play them. That is our local rule. That is not how it works anywhere else, though.
No, absolutely. Thanks for clearing that up. Like I said, I know that's caused a lot of confusion locally, and I'm sure there are some other communities a little confused by that as well. So you talked about how Crucible Guard could impact WTC, and we talked about them as a faction of themselves. But Crucible Guard had some waves in other ponds, namely Convergence and Mercenaries. So should we be expecting to see Crucible Guard models pop up in these other factions?
Yeah, so I think that obviously Laylee's Resistance gets opened up a lot by having access to Crucible Guard models. Crucible Guard infantry, Rocketmen, Assault Troopers, Stormtroopers, and pretty much all the other infantry units all give something to Laylee's Resistance. And like also, Locke is an amazing caster in Convergence. I've talked about this a couple times now, but Grievous Wounds and Precision Strikes is pretty crazy in combination, and Induction and Road to War is also super cute in interactions. I think that if you're a Mercs or Convergence player, this is probably the most excited you should be. Mercs are getting 10 new tools, like in different variations, and Convergence just got a brand new caster. It's super exciting. I think that if you're a player going to conventions and steamrollers, I'd be on the lookout. I'd definitely look up these cards, because if you know some Mercs or Convergence players, they're going to be playing them.
All right, Matt, and real quick, as we kind of wrap up the Crucible Guard review, for those people who just picked up the Crucible Guard army box or a few other things, what are some beginning casters or beginning lists they should really look at to, you know, get their feet wet in the game? Maybe they just came back to the game with this release. So what are some easy lists they could play with the early release models?
All right. So I believe the Toro kit comes out next month. By next month, I mean July. So let's start with that assumption that you have the Crucible Guard army box and the Toro as your legal options. Locke is fantastic. You take a couple, three Toros, three Suppressors, two Vanguards and a Liberator, or, you know, three Liberators or two Liberators, whatever like light jack combination you want. And then you just precision strike, grind your way through armies and like knock them down. And like you take Prospero and he has Vet Leader and he's doing, making all your jacks Mat 7, Rat 6, or if you're a Vanguard, Mat 7, Rat 7. The combination of Precision Strikes, Grievous Wounds, Stationary, and Knockdown creates a situation where you don't have to kill models anymore. You just cut their cortexes out and stationary them. Or as a really good example, I've talked to you about this a few times, is I think Locke is very specifically good into Gatsby 3, whether you're in Convergence or you're in Crucible Guard, because cutting arms off Slayers is super easy. It only takes 14 damage across the chassis. So if you're able to just do that with, let's say, a Galvanizer or two, or like a Toro, it's not unrealistic that a Toro will kill or will cut, you know, both arms off two slayers in an activation, especially with Jackhammer. And once you start doing that, you end up with a really cool list that is not only fun to play, has a lot of really neat interactions, and a really high skill ceiling where you can just progressively get better in the, with the list, but is also just a fundamental brick that cuts through things. If you wanted something on the more infantry side, the only legal infantry caster will be Sevestro for like the next like 3 months, I think. And Sevestro is probably, he is good at everything, but has nowhere where he just really excels. However, he does have purification, and a lot of people have forgotten how strong purification is. I played Sevestro versus Convergence Locke the other day, and she like puts out all her upkeeps, goes up turn one. I'm like, I purify them all off. And he's like, oh, that's just terrible. This matchup's basically unplayable. I'm like, yeah, it's really bad. He also has super stealth. He's a really cool caster, has a lot of really interesting things. So if you were to play Sevestro, you probably, there's actually a really cute list you can make with triple assault troopers and double stormtroopers. So it's 25 medium bases. It's pretty cool.
I'm interested. It sounds like the 2018 meta.
Yeah. Yeah. Medium base. Let's go. So they're all Carapace. They're all Ashen Veil. So they're 13-20 against guns, 11-16 against melee. Sevestro can cast Revive for free every turn. He has access to Transmutation for +2 strength, Pathfinder, and +2 defense. It's just really cool. Like he's also really good with Rocket Men. So like maybe your list looks like Sevestro, two Tauros, a Liberator, double Min Rocket Man with 3 slug guns and a UA, and assault troopers, and then like steelheads with Morally or something. Super cool list. Like the whole component is you just have to build your list out of as many Crucible Guard army boxes as you can. Speaking of army boxes, I really do recommend buying 2 of them at the very least. You get an extra Sevestro and Gorman, which you can share with your friends, which is fine. But you also get the 2 Rocketman units that you need, and you get 2 assault trooper units, which is fantastic. And then additionally, the 2 heavy jacks that come in the kit, if you wait till the Toro comes out, you can build them all as suppressors. You can build them as whatever version you want, magnetized to be whatever. And I think having 4 or 5 or 6 heavy jack chassis will be very good.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to follow up on that, I believe the jacks in the army box were not the entire kit, right? They can only be made as their individual pieces. But what you're saying is wait for the entire kit and just magnetize all of them so you can swap arms throughout all of your chassis.
Yeah, so the jacks that come in the army box are only the kit they are. So like only a suppressor, only a whatever the Vindicator, I think, is the other one. So what I'm saying is the Toro comes out in like a month, let's say. So you don't build those model kits. What you do is you buy a Toro box, and chances are you're not going to want 2 Vindicators. So you're probably only going to want 1. So maybe you magnetize 1 chassis to be a Vindicator, and then the other 2 chassis to be a suppressor and a Toro, or whatever variants you want, right? And I think that's the way I'm going to approach it.
Got it. That makes perfect sense. And anytime people can save money, I know they appreciate it. Real quick, Matt, I know you're a busy man. Before you take off, do you have any pointers or tips for the Merc players looking at Laylee's Resistance? That's a super confusing theme to kind of wrap your head around if you're not an experienced player. You're just kind of inundated with options. Is there one caster and one unit that really sticks out there to you?
Well, I don't think there's... Okay, so Laylee's Resistance is probably my favorite theme in the game. It is so variable. There's so many things you can do with it. And I don't think I can really narrow down to one caster, one unit. But what I can do, I would like to tell you about Menoth, because Laylee's Resistance gained a huge benefit in the Menoth CID. Vengers, Cinerators, Exemplar Errants, Bastions, they all gained amazing changes in the Menoth CID. And those changes directly impact Laylee's Resistance. So Gaston 2 is a really good example. Loves Cinerators. They're 11-17 base. And with their shield wall UA, they go up to 11-21 with Dauntless Resolve for 11-24. They begin Pathfinder because they're Laylee's because of the theme. And then they have a mini feat for Repo 5. So all of a sudden, Gaston now gained a unit that can tank any amount of guns because they're casual 11-24. Or like Bastions do the same thing. Putting the shield guard spell, Life Bond, onto Exemplar Errants is fantastic as well. I think that the big thing with Laylee's resistance is that it's less about what caster and unit you take, but more about what strategy you want to deploy on the table. And I think that when we talk about Crucible Guard and we talk about Rocket Men and we talk about Assault Commandos and we talk about maybe even double Rocket Men, I think Ashlyn DeLees. She's my bottom bitch. love that girl. She is fantastic.
Real quickly, could you take a moment and explain the terminology bottom bitch to some people that may not be familiar with it?
Well, you see, when you're a pimp and you have that one girl who always takes care of your money and always gets her job done, she's your bottom bitch. She's the bitch you can rely on.
thank you very much, Matt. I think some people maybe need that explained to them.
Yeah, I got you. I got you. So Ashlyn DeLees. she's fantastic. She's fantastic. She's great. Vet Leader is really good. Quicken is really good. Making her Jax immune to knockdown and Pathfinder, also really good. And she's also just good in combat. So when you have Rocket Men with Quicken on them, they can take the order for +2 defense and no blast damage. So they start at 14 defense, they go up to 16 with their order, 18 against guns, and then they walk into cover for defense 22 against shooting. That seems fine to me as a unit. Conversely, you put Quicken on them, they take the order for speed 9, so now they're actually speed 11 because of Quicken, and then they walk their 11 inches, shoot their range 10 guns, and then repo 5 away. She's fantastic with them. I think two units of Rocket Men, it also has the benefit in Laylee's resistance of being the most expensive unit you can take, which is actually a really good thing in Laylee's resistance because you are strapped for your free points. So oftentimes when I'm looking at Ashlyn in Laylee's resistance, I do take double Rocket Men with all the trimmings and then just load up with War Jacks and Solos afterwards. And you just get these two fast flanking units with a bunch of Jacks that are immune to knockdown and Pathfinder. And it's fantastic. I did mention Menoth earlier, but at Lock and Load, the tower for Menoth, the shrine of the Lawgiver, did release. So if anyone hasn't played against this thing yet, it's ridiculous. So I think that Privateer Press learned a very valuable lesson from the blockhouse, and we're like, okay, if we're gonna have a big stationary model that shoots every turn, let's make it actually like fantastic. And then they did. They succeeded. It gathers souls from models that die and then returns them at a 1-to-1 soul to model ratio. Like, it's outside of convergence, it's the only thing in the game that does that.
No, absolutely, and it can use the souls to boost its ridiculous range 14, POW 14 magic gun that kicks out a spray and has Trusight?
Yep, that's accurate. Played Dark Host into it, and I lost almost 2 units of Banes across 3 turns just to the gun.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
It's ridiculous.
And it's a fantastic contesting piece, as you kind of alluded to earlier, with how live some of these scenarios are getting.
Yeah, like you just play, like on Mirage, you just put that structure next to your objective, that's the repair objective, and it just gets repaired for D3 every turn, casually, shoots units off the table, and also returns models at a 1-to-1 ratio. You're like, oh man, my incinerators are dying, I guess I'll bring back the whole unit. It's fantastic. That structure is great. I love it. I've never wanted to play Menoth more.
No, and it comes with an awesome potholder as well. I'm not sure if you saw that.
Oh, I mean, I saw a bunch of people running around with them at Lock and Load. Some guy actually bought 2 of the Shrine of the Lawgiver so you could have 2 oven mitts.
I recommended to one of my local Menoth players that he build a Shrine of the Lawgiver out of Legos. And just play it as such. And I'm really hoping that someone out there does that.
Yeah, just to touch back on Lock and Load real quick. That convention was genuinely fun. The energy there, the staff was super excited. They obviously announced Infernals. Everyone was hyper excited about the Guardian Supreme. I don't know if that's actually its name, but I want to imagine it is. The giant stone battle engine. It was a really great convention, and I highly recommend traveling to it if you ever get an opportunity. I know one of your locals was there, Nick.
Nick was there, yes, he was. I had a couple locals out there. I just had some family things, schedules looking a little busy, so I personally had to bow out.
Yeah, I ran into Nick a few times. I gave him the old finger guns, and we talked about our games. It was a really good convention. Met a lot of really interesting people. Really recommend it. Check it out, guys.
Yeah, my locals that did go all came back super inspired, which is, you guys know, is one of the goals of this podcast. And most of them are pretty casual players. I don't think they'd take offense to me saying that. So again, right, get it out of your head that these big conventions are only made for people that are trying to qualify for the Invitational. There are tons of really fun things and activities to do there. And the larger ones like War Machine Weekend and Lock and Load really exemplify that. There are so many small events to do. I don't know what was happening, but my friends were sending me pictures of people storming a castle. There's all sorts of small scrambles. And then you can wait in giant lines to buy models that no one else has. So there's just a lot of really cool things to do out there.
Yeah. Speaking of, you know, going to conventions, maybe this will be just a little piece of advice for everyone that's planning to go to a convention where they do model releases early. Have a set budget for what you're prepared to buy for people. My first War Machine Weekend, I spent $500 on models for other people. And it was a real hassle chasing down people and getting them their models in a reasonable amount of time. I actually still have some of them to this day. So just remember that you're there for yourself. Take care of you first, and then take care of everyone else. Secondly, biggest tip for a convention, if you're ever going to go to one, don't say no. If something sounds fun, go do it. Like, I walked by a scramble after I was on like round 4 of the IG or something like that. I walked by a scramble where I looked across the tables and there's like 4 WTC players, like a couple like really like cool guys I met over the weekend. A staff member was playing a game. It was just like a super varied thing and like an ultra casual event. And like multiple WTC members from across the world too. And it was really cool. Like one of my friends walked up to me after his game against, I think it was Jake Wilstrop, who he walked up to me and he's like, "Well, I thought I was, you know, I was favored in that matchup." And then he ripped out my intestines and waved them at my face. and he's like, "Oh, I lost like half my army in one turn. That was really bad." And he walked away from that game, instead of being like, "Oh man, I should have won that," and like being upset, he walked away feeling great, like, "Oh man, this was a really cool experience." And then he went and did another scramble later. And like, that's the best thing that could happen. Being excited and taking away like inspiration from an event like that feels really good. And that's what cons always do for me.
Awesome. So on that note, are there any other conventions coming up before you head to WTC?
Yeah, so in about 20 days now, we have TGX, which is in Toronto. Was actually in Mississauga. The current plan for TGX is that I will be going up a week early to play a tournament at Black Knight Games, which is Tim Bankey's local store. Hopefully record some episodes of Arcane Assist, and then travel to TGX and probably lose a bunch of games to Jake Van Meter.
That sounds like a great week.
Yeah, like I'm actually super excited. Anytime I get to hang out with cool people, I'm excited, and that's all cons are for me. After TGX, we have Nova. Again, first year going to Nova. I got talked into it by Tim, and we're going. A couple locals, and Tim and I are all driving down together, and I'm really excited. I'm excited to see the Soretti's there. I love that family. It's going to be a super cool event. I know very little about it other than it's the Nova, and I'm going to go, and it's the last event before WTC.
Nova is very, it feels a lot like Gen Con. Have you been to Gen Con? Is that helpful information?
It is not helpful information.
There's a lot going on. It's very loud. There's tons of people. Yeah, but Nova is in Washington, D.C. That is the capital of this great country that you saved, just so you know, and anyone else. All right, Matt. Well, hopefully, like I said, you can see Matt coming up at TGX or at Nova. And then if you happen to be lucky enough to go into the WTC, you can follow Matt there. Matt, what's the team name you're on again?
The team name? So we want to be Team Canada Wolverine. That's what we want. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think we're going to be Team Canada Moose, I think. Maybe Goose. I don't know how the team names work. I don't make the rules. I just play War Machine.
Okay. Well, be sure to look out for Matt coming up at TGX, Nova, or at WTC. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, man. Always excited to talk to you.
And that wraps up today's episode of Tangential with Sung Su.
Be sure to follow me on Facebook at CO Wargame to stay up to date with all my content. You can also find me on Twitter at Sung Su. I'd love to hear from everyone, good, bad, or otherwise. I'd like to thank Matt for coming on the show. There's definitely a chance that Matt and I make this podcasting duo a more common thing. So if you'd like to hear that, if you'd like to see more of that, let us know on social media. I'd also like to thank Muse on Minis for hosting all my podcast adventures. I hope this podcast was educational, entertaining, and inspiring. Till next time, cheers.